This Week in Retronauts, in space, no one can hear you podcast. Everyone, welcome to episode... some such, I don't know, what is it? I'm going to say episode 220. Let's see if I'm right. Episode 220 of Retronauts. My goodness, that's so many Retronauts. And I'm Jeremy Parrish, still here 220 episodes later, talking about video games and things related to video games, mostly things related to video games in this episode. And with me here as my accomplices in this criminal act, we have...
Ben Elgin. I might have been on like 20 of these, maybe. I don't know. Possibly. Maybe up to that by now.
Perhaps.
Chris Sims, the ultimate in alien terror.
Ben Jedwards. And I've probably been on like 40 of these now already.
Right. And you have like an inside mouth, a mouth inside your mouth that comes out and like clamps that's into people's true. Faces. Yeah.
Don't talk like this. The mouth inside my mouth.
I cannot imagine anything that would freak me out more than a tiny bench head tiny. Coming out of regular sized bench head's mouth.
We're going to stop thinking about that right now.
Yeah. So this horrifying episode is it's appropriate because the topic we're delving into this week is the movie Alien, not the Alien franchise, not Aliens, and not really that many Alien games, just Alien the movie, because it just turned 40. Oh my God. 1979, April 26th. Is that correct? Was the 40th anniversary or the original release of 1979. Yes. Was the original release of the movie Alien. And that means it is 40. And this movie had such a massive impact on pop culture. Maybe not so much as its sequel, but it was significant in a different way. And it stands, you know, 40 years later as a singular work. Like, there's never been a movie quite like it. And certainly none of the sequels have managed to succeed in the same way that the original Alien did. And because of that, and because of the video games that it inspired, and the comic books, and the many, many other things, we're going to talk about Alien and why it was one of the greatest movies of all time. Do you guys agree?
It was pretty good.
I have mixed feelings these days.
So it turns out I hadn't. I was 2.5 when Alien came out the first time, so I didn't see it right then. I actually wasn't sure about this because it's such a part of pop culture that, you know, you absorb the major beats of it. And I actually didn't remember whether I'd actually seen the whole movie or not. Turns out I hadn't. I realized as I was sitting down to rewatch it.
For this podcast. You had not podcast. Seen the whole thing until just recently.
I had not seen the whole thing until about 3 days ago. I sat down and watched it through. That was an experience.
Interesting.
There were obviously like all these scenes that I'd seen because they get replayed everywhere. Mm-hmm. But I definitely had not seen it the whole way through before.
So what is your take as a fresh-faced young man coming into the world of Alien?
So, you know, I mean, it's very obviously of its time. Like, it's one of those things like... it was great. But it's one of those things like, you know, the original 2001 where you can't get away with making a movie paced like this anymore. With this kind of slow build.
But you can. Well, it's just it's going to be...
A flop.
No, things like, Jordan Peele's movies are very much kind of this like slow creeping build.
Well, okay.
I think there is space for this kind of movie. It's just it won't be a blockbuster in the Avengers mold, but that's a different kind of movie.
That's a good point.
Yeah, this is a movie that does, you know, it explores the depth of the genre of science fiction. It's actually more of a horror movie, but it's still undeniably science fiction.
Yeah. And it was fun revisiting sort of this, the whole late 70s, early 80s science fiction milieu, like the same kind of things you get in Star Wars with these great models and just like, you know, doing a lot on not necessarily that much budget, not having, you know, the computer effects and all that. And then, you know, I'm not the kind of guy who says like the pre-computer stuff was always better, but it's really interesting to see what you could pull off.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some stuff in this movie that is in terms of effects work that has not aged well.
Yeah.
And that, you know, if they could enhance it digitally, I wouldn't complain. But for the most part, the use of practical effects, the fact that there was a real person inside that rubber alien costume, like that lends the movie a lot more realism. I mean, you know, it, like I said, it's a horror movie in a lot of ways. And so much of the movie, the suspense and the fear of it is reflected in the actors, and they are actually acting against something. They're not acting against, you know, a ping pong ball on a stick or whatever Jar Jar Binks was. They're reacting to a guy in a rubber costume that's dripping with goop and blood. And there's like in the chest burster scene, that's real blood, real ox guts. It's right. It's like horrifying.
Well, and there's the famous story about how, like, you know, the actors knew generally what was going to happen, but they hadn't been told about the like high pressure blood spurts and stuff. So a lot of that was actually them reacting to suddenly getting sprayed.
Like, can't get that kind of responses, that kind of acting with digital reactions digital effects and green screen, because it's different. Like, there's nothing there to react against.
But I sort of got both sides of this old effects coin with that one scene, because, like, you know, the actors reacting in that scene was fantastic. But then, like, the actual chestburster coming out and running away, it's just impossible in my mind to separate that from the Hello My Honey, Hello My Baby version now.
Yeah.
I just, like, I can't.
Yeah.
Like,
do you think we've come back around to the point where, like, you could do, like, a blockbuster movie and one of the selling points would be, it's all practical effects?
I mean, Mad Max Fury Road was much about the practical effects, and it made it such a difference. Like, there's such, you know, like those desert chase scenes are so convincing because it's actually dudes out there who are crazy, like risking their necks on these like suspended things. And there's actually, you know, vehicles out there smashing into each other and a guy with an electric guitar shooting flames on the back of a truck. You can always tell
when the guitar is really shooting fire.
And yeah. I think the best things coming out today are the things that know how to combine the two, to use practical when it's the best and to use CG when it's the best. And I think, like, so that's one of the huge skills in being a director or producer today, is knowing when to go with what and how to combine them convincingly.
Was that a selling point on Fury Road? I remember hearing about it much after,
No, it wasn't like a big deal in advance. No one was like, hey, it's practical effects, it's real people out in the desert, you know, chasing cars. But as that came out, people became increasingly aware and increasingly impressed by just how much George Miller accomplished with, you know, traditional methods and processes. And, you know, the fact that digital effects were mostly used to embellish as opposed to replace.
Yeah.
That's a significant distinction.
Episode 7 had, J.J. Abrams was talking about using a lot of practical effects on Episode 7, Star Wars, before it came out, because it's going to be like more authentic. Instead of like George Lucas's like prequels were all CGI green screen kind of things. Crazy.
Yeah, there weren't a whole lot of Dex Jetsters in The Force Awakens, and that was nice.
Yeah.
I am an increasingly curmudgeonly old man where, like, I just like models and matte paintings. I love matte paintings.
Yeah, they're cool. So the alien effects, there are a couple scenes. I just watched it last night, and a few things struck me about the effects, which is that the last time I watched it, it wasn't a high-definition TV set. And so now I see a lot of the, like, there's a part where Ash's head gets knocked off. And then he's sitting on a table and they boot him back up and they switch.
You can see when they...
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously like, just the plaster mannequin head or whatever they've fashioned. And then the actor's head through a table.
But it actually works because he is a deactivated robot. So yeah, he's going to look weird and fake when he's off. I'm okay with that.
It's just too fake looking. But that's also with 40 years of experience watching movies and sophistication and effects after that. So I can imagine at the time these things being incredibly crazy and wild. And in fact, the alien itself, just in the, I don't know, I think I haven't seen it for 10 years, but the alien, the behavior of the alien is really cheesy to me. The last time I saw it, like, there's a scene where it comes at this somebody and it opens its mouth and
death by jazz hands.
Like the jazz hands. I wrote down that exact same thing in my head. Like, that one did not work.
Like,
for
spreads
me.
Its fingers out. Like, oh my gosh, that's
like
not scary.
Some of the scenes with the alien worked for me and some of them didn't. Yeah, the jazz hands when the captain got killed was not one of the ones that worked for me.
Yeah, but you need to see it on the big screen. I saw it like 15 years ago. In say the 25th anniversary in San Francisco.
Is that the last time you saw it?
No. Okay. I watch it pretty regularly, actually, because I think it's one of the greatest movies of all time.
It's a great film, and it's incredibly influential, but I feel like I'm seeing these dated things.
Sure, and you just have to kind of accept that. I mean, I saw Avengers last week, and guess what? I can see things that are not going to age well in like 2 years because digital effects are going to jump forward. There's, you know, like I look at the CG model for the Hulk, and I'm like, well, that's a pretty good impersonation of Mark Ruffalo, but it's still an impersonation of Mark Ruffalo, and it's not going to look any better further out. Yeah. You just have to expect, you know, accept the fact that there are just limitations on what you can do with effects, whether it's digital, practical, whatever, and that's fine.
And some of them really did work. Like, I thought, like, one of the first scenes where you see the folio, and it's when it's kind of somersaulting down out of the ductwork to kill the first guy it kills, like, that one worked for me.
Well, that's because they hired like a dude who was really tall and lanky, yeah, and could, you know, he's like 6'10", and he was an African art student working in London. And they were just like, you have this uncanny look about you, this, like, your body, you know, kind of like Doug Jones now, mm-hmm, like, just, you know, a little inhuman almost, just with the proportions. And so they coached him and were like, you know, can you do these things? And the ones he couldn't do, they had a stunt guy to step in for him, because he wasn't an actor. He wasn't a stuntman, so he didn't have a lot of experience doing that. But, you know, I feel like almost that naivete kind of comes into play, because the alien is just uncanny. It's a real thing there in the space with everyone else.
That would be an incredibly rude thing to tell someone.
What? That you are uncanny?
You have a very uncanny look to you, almost inhuman.
I mean, Doug Jones looks kind of inhuman.
I mean,
that's like his career right there.
You are
there.
Not incorrect about that.
And, you know, I love Mr. Saru on Star Trek Discovery, and I'm happy that he got laid as a fish man. That's great. but, you know, that's like made a living out of it, so that's awesome.
I'd like to say one more thing about the pacing point that Chris was talking about, which blew my mind, is that at the very end of the film, if this is a spoiler, I apologize, but she's in the ship by herself, and she's about
she being the main character, Ripley.
Yeah, Ripley. Yeah, Ripley.
Ripley Scott.
Yeah. So she's in the what do you call it? The jet thing.
The escape pod. The Narcissus.
Narcissus, yes.
Anyway, so she's there, and then suddenly she's just looking around. She's half naked and stuff. And then she sees the alien sitting
like
there.
5/6 naked.
Yeah, 5/6 naked. And she sees this alien like just hanging out in the bulkhead, just sitting there. And then she's like, oh, crap, the alien's there. And then suddenly she's like, oh, she backs off slowly and goes and hides in a closet and watches it. And it's just kind of sitting there. Like, that's something that would not happen today in a film. Like, what is that alien doing lying down there just relaxing in the bulkhead? Like, what is going on? And why does she have so much time to go get in the suit and do all this stuff? Why doesn't it come get her? You know, today it would be some crazy, like, super 60 like frames per second thing going swirling around and stuff. But, you know, that's something that would never happen in a film these days in terms of pacing and stuff.
I don't
Do you
know.
Remember that? Has anybody watched it last night? Like,
yeah, I know. Like, at the end, she's like the creature has gotten into the shuttle and it's basically going into hibernation.
Yeah, I feel like it lends some depth to it, that, like, you know, this is an alien creature and we don't know what its like behavior patterns are. Like, you know, if it has cycles of like being on and off and whatever, and it's just and on the other hand, it also you know, lets you question like what its intelligence level is. Like, did it realize the ship was self-destructing and it had to get off?
Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was so just allergic to strobing lights.
Yeah, I mean, that's that. Yeah.
Oof, maybe it was just lights. Following the kitty. Who knows?
There's two things that I really love about the movie. And I think one of them really ties into what Ben was just saying, that it's one of the first times in a long time, like since like weird, like 50s sci-fi stuff, like The Blob, that you have like an alien monster, like humans versus an alien, and the alien is just completely alien. Like, it doesn't reproduce in a way that we recognize. Like, the look of it is weird, and we're all kind of like used to it, but that's such a great design because it's got the right parts, right? It's got like a head and arms and legs, but they're all wrong.
Right.
Which goes
look
back
like a
to,
penis, basically.
And you get this, and you get this really interesting glimpse into it because we see this whole life cycle play out over the course of the movie. So it's clearly, you know, this complex orgasm and it's got all this stuff going on and you learn some of it, but it's so alien that you don't necessarily know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
One of the great things about seeing the movie in HD is that you see that the alien mask is actually translucent and there is like a humanoid skull underneath there. Like it's really hard to notice that, but there are a few scenes where you kind of get those glimpses of light and you're like, whoa, that's way creepier than I thought it was.
Yeah. And you look at like the other two popular science fiction franchises of the time. You've got Star Wars, where the aliens are just people in suits who sometimes talk in weird voices. And you've got Star Trek, where the aliens are all metaphors. And the alien in Alien is not a metaphor. It is just a thing.
But it is kind of. It's
an animal.
It's kind of a metaphor for sexual assault, honestly.
Well,
I mean, they deliberately reached out to H.R. Giger, the Swiss artist, because his work was all just like bio-organic sexual erotica.
Yeah. And like, Bannon, the guy who wrote the script, is like on the record as saying, like, yes, like I am trying to like sexually assault the audience with this. And not so much the women, but the men with like all these fears of like, you know, penetration and oral rape and impregnation and all this stuff.
You know, I don't want to get too much into that, that way.
Like that was very much intentional in there. Yeah.
I was thinking of a metaphor like Frank Gorshin saying that the guy with the face paint on the other half of his face.
Right. Yeah, it's not that. Yeah.
But yeah, like I actually honestly had never considered that. And it makes so much sense. So,
so you're saying the alien was a giant walking penis?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it was designed by H.R. Giger to be specifically a giant walking penis with teeth.
Wow.
It's like vagina dentata, but flipped around on its side. It's meant to be, again, uncanny, horrible, unknowable, like revolting on this fundamental level that freaks people out. And that's a big reason that it's so, that alien design is so memorable. Like there are so many video games and so many, you know, science fiction works that have taken that design and just run with it. Like Giger's visuals have become basically currency in pop culture because of this alien design. It's so weird and horrifying.
Visceral.
And then like everything that's built around it, the story as well, just props that up. It's not just a freaky looking monster. It is a monster whose entire existence is wrong and offensive and hostile.
It doesn't have eyes.
It does not
have
eyes.
Which is a very important thing.
Yeah. Like, but it does have like sockets in the translucent part of the skull, but you don't see eyes there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It bleeds acid that melts through the ship.
Yep.
Yeah. It's toxic on every level and utterly inhuman.
And
on every
it has
level.
Like silica like armor or something, so it doesn't, it's hard to damage and stuff. Yeah, it's terrifying.
And its whole modus operandi is to like attack and impregnate you. Like
honestly, really shocked that I did not get the metaphor till just now. I feel like a real idiot.
As usual, we have... You feel like an idiot. No, this is a segue. As usual, we have gone almost 20 minutes into this podcast without really giving like the basic rundown. We started, we were so close, and then we got sidetracked. So
people have had 40 years.
Yeah, well, not everyone's been there. So if you are brand new to Alien, congratulations, welcome. There's a terrifying and fascinating movie experience ahead of you. But Alien was, again, released in 1979, and... was very much a movie kind of cut from the cloth of 2001, Star Wars. Came out around the same time as Star Trek The Motion Picture, a few months, like 6 months before that. And both of those movies were, it had basically kind of been languishing for a while in the studio back burner. And then the success of Star Wars made the studio say, oh, we need one of those too. And what they came up with for Star Trek was, you know, kind of like a basically like a prelude to The Next Generation, a very sort of slow paced, ponderous, intellectual take on Star Trek.
With
no metaphorical guys.
You're talking about slow pacing. I mean, this the first Star Trek movie.
I love it. It's languid.
It's no Star Trek V.
No, it's definitely no Star Trek V, and thank God. but what Fox came up with for Alien is like the anti-Star Wars. It's hard to imagine this movie was greenlit. I mean, it's got more in common with John Carpenter's The Thing, which actually came later. It is very much a horror movie in the sort of like Michael Myers, Halloween, Friday the 13th slasher mold. And that was something that was just beginning to take off, you know, Leatherface, what was that, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but, you know, tied to science fiction. And, it's an interesting proposition, and there was nothing else like it at the time. So the premise of the movie is that basically some space truckers, are rerouted by their bosses to check out an emergency signal from an uncharted planet. So they go and they find this like space wreck, and inside the space wreck, they find these weird eggs, and one of the eggs pops open and sticks something to one of the crewman's face. So they take him back into the ship. Even though Ripley's like quarantine, the evil robot says no. We don't know he's evil. He's just a dick. And, so they bring the guy into the ship, and everything seems okay. The face thing goes away after a while, after they realize they can't kill it, but it just leaves on its own. And they're like, oh, everything's great. Let's go back into space hibernation, have one last meal, eat some food. Oh my God, we were eating dinner and all of a sudden something blew out of his chest and now it killed everyone. So basically there's this monster loose in their space truck, and, it kills off pretty much everyone except the one person who was like quarantine. And she manages to escape with a kitten. And the alien gets blasted out into space, and then they made many sequels.
Thank goodness the cat survives.
Yeah. And that's the other thing that I really like about Alien. Not the cat.
The cat's probably part great. Of it.
You mentioned before we were on mic, like talking about it. It's a working class space adventure, and you always hear in Star Wars. That it was like one of the first sci-fi movies to show like degradation on the spaceships from traveling through space. Like they get hit with stuff, and so they need to be repaired.
People live inside of them. I mean, if you look at the Millennium Falcon in Solo versus the Millennium Falcon in A New Hope, like this is a bachelor and his large hairy pal that live in the spaceship by themselves, and you can just like look at the Falcon inside and be like, that smells so bad in there. It smells like socks.
But in Alien, like Han Solo's like a cool guy with a cool job. Like he's a smuggler. He has a gun. In Alien, they're all, it's the first time that I remember really seeing just people have jobs.
Yeah,
like menial, boring jobs in space.
Salt of the earth.
Two of the characters, like their primary motivation in this movie is like getting a better cut of the Discovery. They're just like, we want a better percentage. You know, this was not in our contract, so give us a better percentage. They're just working class guys.
They're mechanics. Yeah. I mean, this also differentiates this from other like slasher movies, which are mostly about a bunch of teens getting killed. These are working class adults.
The characters, you know, the youngest of the cast, I think, was Sigourney Weaver, who was 28, 29.
Yeah, something like
and,
that.
And, you know, Tom Skerritt, I think, was like almost 50.
Yeah, most of them were in their 40s.
Yeah.
Which, in all fairness, like, even though I feel like it's, in pacing and in content, a markedly different movie, I do feel like you do get a lot of that in Aliens because, you know, they're all soldiers, but they all feel like they're people who do jobs.
Right.
But that all leads to the moral of Alien, which is if you thought capitalism was bad on Earth, wait till it gets to space.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing, is it's not just blue collar guys. It's a coalition of seven people. That's one of the interesting things about this movie. There are only seven people plus the alien who appear on camera. Like it is a small cast. It is almost, it's kind of like a bottle
it's a
episode,
bottle, yeah.
But it's not, because it takes place across, you know, several parts of the Nostromo, the space truck,
which is still a pretty tight location.
It is, but then there's also several spaces in the planet. And then there's the Narcissus, the shuttle. So I find the ship itself really interesting, because you get this picture of this gigantic starship flying through space, but it's not like an Imperial Star Destroyer in Star Wars. It is an ore refinery carrying like 20,000 tons of
million.
Ore, 20 million. Okay. Yeah. Million, just like a ridiculous volume of ore. And the space vehicle itself, the Nostromo, is actually very small, and it mostly consists of engines.
It's a tugboat.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's just pulling this huge ore refinery through space that's, I guess, churning away and refining the things they've mined from other planets as they're back en route to Earth to sell it or turn it into the company or whatever. But the Nostromo itself has kind of a sort of clearly regimented spaces. You've got like the common mess. You've got the cockpit. You've got the computer center, which is very clean and antiseptic. It looks like nothing else on this ship. And, you know, some other common spaces where there's like pinups and stuff on the wall. It's just like working class dudes. It's kind of gross and dirty in there. And then there's like the bowels of the ship where the mechanics work. And that place is weird. It's like all steam and pipes, and it's just like constantly dripping from condensation because of the heat of the engines or the heater of the refinery. I don't know. But like the ship is never really explained, and you just get a sense of like, these are these people who live and work in this space, and they're how many light years away from anything else in the known universe. Like, it's a very lonely kind of isolated experience, and that just makes the horror worse because there's nowhere for them to run to. They are on this ship, and they like all they can do is try to survive and kill this alien invader that's taken over their ship, or that it's not even taken over. It's just prowling and killing everyone.
It's very much like the sci-fi equivalent of like a mining town, or like a company town, you know, like, or a logging camp, a mining camp, where you like they definitely get paid in like
shit.
Yeah. What's the company?
Weyland-Yutani.
Weyland-Yutani. Yeah. That's it.
Weyland-Yutani.
They get paid in Weyland-Yutani fun bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can spend them at any Weyland-Yutani location.
But yeah, I mean, it's actually, it feels like one of those sci-fi movies that was very predictive of the future, because that whole like weird hybrid of military and corporate space is really kind of happened already. And, you know, you get out, take, you know, military contractors, PMCs out into outer space, and you probably have something that looks a lot like Weyland-Yutani.
Well, and then of course the crisis situation extrapolates to the extreme, where the computer decides on orders from headquarters that, you know, it has this new priority, and by the way, that means the crew is now expendable.
Yeah. Like it doesn't matter if everyone dies, just as long as you bring the alien back. And that's why Ripley gets in trouble, because everyone dies and she doesn't bring the alien back. She kills that mofo.
Although, what about the cat? Is it impregnated with an alien that gets out in the next film?
No.
No.
It is not.
I'd like to bring up something about the computers. It's fun. As a vintage computer guy, I love the computers
in this
film.
Yeah.
And it's funny how they reflect the sensibility of the late 70s in terms of the sound people made them sound like teletypes. They're like, like all this stuff when it's printing out stuff on a CRT, which never happens, of course, but that was like what you'd think of as a computer at the time. And it struck, I was watching this with my wife last night. And we've come so far from that. It's cool for me. I remember the text interfaces, obviously, and all that stuff. But she was watching this, and she's like, "Who's mother?" It's like, isn't that obvious? It's the computer.
You know, mother-thur. Come
it's
on.
Like Siri on your phone. Oh, So I'm like, I'm thinking now that we know these computing metaphors because we grew up with them and we know them. But there may be future generations who are actually confused about what this means doing with this computer. And
I mean,
how does not compute, and what they're talking to it.
I definitely could see Alexa saying that my life is expendable and telling the Android to kill me. Like that's going to happen in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
But there's also, I mean, there's also a lot of really interesting design that just went into all this retro computer stuff.
It's like the beautiful equipment.
It's like there's a lot that's like, doesn't actually make any sense, but is very striking. Like the actual like mother control center, which has just literally lights. Thousands of indicator lights across all. I mean, like there's no way this could actually be useful, but, but it's a really striking visual.
But I mean, if you look at like a space shuttle control panel, they look like that. They've got all these indicator lights.
I mean, even though.
You need to know what they mean.
Cockpit.
Yeah.
But he's talking. I mean, it's like thousands and thousands of little.
It's so pretty,
lights.
A lot to worry about.
It's very well, I
there's one that says alien.
I want to build a room like that. There's like a dome igloo with the lights all around it. That looks awesome. I wonder if any fan has recreated that because I'd like.
Probably. I mean, they've recreated the Enterprise bridge, so you feel like Mother's control room is in there too.
And there's all these weird little touches. Like I actually paused the movie on there's a control panel that I think is in the escape shuttle that just has all these keys with different iconography on them. And if you pause it and look at them, they say things like Linga Yoni Shakti Excess Druze Pile Pranic Lift. And
So it's actually about like the Kama Sutra?
It's all Sanskrit. And so I actually looked this up because I was hella curious. And evidently the guy who designed that control panel, it was very last second. He needed some weird technical sounding things. And evidently he was reading this book by this like Russian person into weird conspiracy theories who was into this Sanskrit stuff. And so that's why there's these random Sanskrit words.
I thought
words
I saw
on this
some Cyrillic
panel.
Characters on there.
There's a lot of random iconography that you
have. And it kind of works because the Nostromo crew is so multicultural. Like there's no... There are no set roles by race or by gender. I mean, the basically kind of the hardline like corporate person. You know, we gotta keep on the clock. Everyone, you know, by the rules. That's Ripley. She's like a young woman. She's the youngest member of the crew. She's a woman. The pilot is a woman. And it's not the black guy who dies first.
That's actually one of the really refreshing things about watching this movie today is all the white guys die first.
It's the seasoned captain. Like you think, oh, the captain, he's the hero. He's the Captain Kirk or whatever. No, he gets killed. He gets taken. And, you know, there's like a deleted scene where he actually gets, you see him captured and like strung up in a cocoon. And he's like, kill me, please. And that's something they actually added back into some of the later cuts. When I saw it in the theater 15 years ago, they had added that in. And I feel like it adds something. You're like, whoa, there's more going on here. It's not just like the alien is killing people, but it's keeping them alive for some other reason.
Yeah. The cut I saw last night didn't have the cocoon thing in it. And I was disappointed.
Yeah, the original theatrical
cut
doesn't.
I feel like how many cuts of this are there? Because I feel like I saw new things last night when I was watching this that I didn't see the last time I see this movie.
No Blade Runner, but there are several cuts.
Yeah, the one that I saw, because I am notoriously not a fan of scary movies, but I don't. I mean, it's a horror movie and it's scary, but not in the same way as the kind of movie I don't like. So I didn't see this until I was in my 20s. And I believe I watched the director's cut on DVD.
And Ridley Scott's into those director's cuts.
Yeah. Although Blade Runner is actually, also Ridley Scott.
Although I think Ridley Scott was actually on record saying originally that he preferred the theatrical cut of this one, that like he had done the director's cut at the behest of the studio. And like it was okay, but a lot of the things were cut for a reason. He didn't necessarily even like it better.
So. I think Alien works better in the director's cut form. I think Aliens works better in the theatrical cut because the theatrical cut of that shows like the Newt's family finding the alien on LV-234 or whatever it is.
SR.
No, that's the wrong one. it shows them finding the family like early in the movie, and it just takes away all the suspense because in Aliens you don't see the xenomorphs until like. It's like 40 or 45 minutes into the movie. It's or maybe not quite that far, but it's a long ways into the movie. And that's the same thing here. Like an alien, you don't see the alien for a long time. It's like the last third of the movie that you really, you know, that it's like just killing off the crew and stalking the ship. Up until that point, it's about, you know, these people waking up and trying to figure out what's going on, why they've been called to this other planet, exploring the other planet, like figuring out what the hell is down here. What's this giant like elephant dude in a navigator chair? Why is he turned into stone and there's like a hole in his chest? What are all these weird eggs with a laser over like the laser mist over top of them? It's weird and mysterious and the movie never explains it. And then, you know, Ridley Scott has made Prometheus and all these other movies that explain it and we don't need that.
Yeah.
The laser effect was quite. That was actually another thing I looked up because I'm like, was that a laser layer over the eggs? And so I looked at it and it was yes. Apparently, yeah, they borrowed the lasers from the Who was filming next door in the sound studio.
But I love that, you know, it's a laser, but they have like this Foley in there. When he puts his hand and breaks the laser, there's like this sound. You're like, what is that?
Yeah, and it's just, and there's this fog, and it's really like, it's just like another like strata of that alien ship that yeah. houses
And then the he says, Captain, we've discovered a Who concert.
Yeah.
Getting back to what you were saying about the crew and the kind of multicultural makeup of the crew, I feel like it's definitely intentional that that our heroine is our heroine and that the captain dies. Because I feel like there's a very logical progression from watching an episode of Star Trek and being like, he's going to wrestle the alien.
The Gorn? Really?
The Gorn? Okay. And then watching Star Wars and being like, okay, but how did they make that thing that's the size of a moon? And then you get to this, which is sort of the answer to both of those. But I'm wondering if you think that's the makeup of the crew is intentionally meant to counteract or maybe even accentuate the fact that this is an inherently, in a very literal sense, xenophobic movie. Like, this is First Contact.
No, literally when they cast the movie, they were told, like, these characters were written unisex.
Okay.
They could be, any character could be any gender, any age, really. Just hire the best actors for the roles. So they hired the people that were best for the roles. That's literally all they did. So the cast they ended up with, I mean, of the entire crew, I think John Hurt was probably the biggest star, but Yaphet Kotto was probably the second biggest at the time. So, you know, it's they went with a lot of unknowns, like who the hell was Veronica Cartwright? Who the hell was Sigourney Weaver?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like, you know, Harry Dean Stanton is kind of a long experienced character actor. So it's a really interesting mix of actors, really. And everyone does fit their part because they are all so different. I mean, from Ian Holm playing the kind of politely sociopathic android who has a secret agenda, to Ripley being the pragmatic, practical survivor, to Tom Skerritt being just like this extremely tired, just, you know, whatever, captain. Like, we just got to do this thing and move on. You know, we've got the next job coming up. We got to get back to Earth. Like, everyone is just cast perfectly. And, you know, a big part of what makes this movie work is the actual screen chemistry, because the director, Ridley Scott, filmed it in a very naturalistic style. It was not, like, everything is not super scripted. There's a lot of improv and a lot of people playing off each other. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of quiet, muffled dialogue where people are making asides and things like that that you don't see in modern movies. You know, mm-hmm. where everything is either like scripted rigidly, or it's a Seth Rogen comedy where everything is just like wacky improv. But, you know, this is a different kind of improv, and it's just about people living in their lives and being like inhabiting their roles. And it really, really helps sell the characters, I think. Like, you really kind of feel like they work together, and sometimes they don't really like each other that much, but they're all stuck together in this space tugboat for who knows how many years. And that's just the life they live.
I noticed that when I was watching it, about the mumbled, muffled, mm-hmm. over-talking dialogue and the echoey, you know, they're walking around exploring the ship, and they're just talking about stuff they see and things like that. And it doesn't, you don't really hear it, but it's just like color.
Yeah. You don't get that these days because like people complain that there's something wrong with the sound, you know, right. Every line isn't crystal clear, but there was definitely a lot of just, you know, like crosstalk and just like,
yeah. And they even play with that. The scene where Ripley is arguing with the two mechanics, mm-hmm. and they're actually like, not tormenting her, but being deliberately obstinate by opening up the steam valve. So it's creating all this noise, and they're just like shouting at each other. You don't really know what they're saying. And then she leaves and they turn off the steam valve and just chuckle about how they were harassing her.
Yeah.
But it's not in like a sexual harassment kind of way. It's just like, you know, we're just being kind of dickish and we want our fair cut. And, you know, she represents the corporation, mm-hmm. and we are the people who are actually doing the hard work. So, you know, why make life easy for her?
I'd like to say something about the character of Ripley, which is that in watching this last night, I was struck by it. It took a while in the movie before Ripley actually says or does anything, too. Like, we think of her as the main character now because we know she survives and she goes through the other film series. But if they played it up in a way, I think, that you don't know what the heck is going to happen, who's going to survive, who will be the last person out. Which is obvious in retrospect. True,
yeah. Right.
She's very much a secondary character in like the first like third of the movie.
Yeah, and again, the biggest actor in the movie, John Hurt, is the first guy to die. They they kill him off. This is what they wanted to do with the TV series Lost. They wanted to hire like Michael Keaton and have him as Jack Shepard and then kill him at the end of the first episode. So everyone was like, wait a minute, he's the big star and he's dead? What's going on? Like, they did exactly that with Alien. They killed off John Hurt and that's it. Like, he's got a hole in his chest and everyone's spattered with pig blood. And there's this like weird little thing running around the ship now.
What do you think about Ripley as a heroine surviving? That was innovative in that era.
It's still innovative.
Yeah.
But I mean, we still have aliens. Like, well, she really becomes an action hero in the next film.
I mean, that's kind of tying into the horror roots. There is a trope in horror movies called The Last Girl. Where, like, you know, the sensible, smart woman is the one who survives. You know, the Scream movies, I think, did that, or at least the first one. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Yeah.
But that is very much a horror thing. Like, you know, the one who survives is the practical, smart, thoughtful woman who doesn't rush headlong into things, but actually takes the time to figure out how to outsmart the monster. And I feel like that really does tie into the horror leanings of Alien, but you don't see it as much in sci-fi for sure. Yeah. Sci-fi is all like, you know, it's the original poster for Star Wars where Luke Skywalker is like super muscular. He's got a bare chest and he's holding a laser sword and Princess Leia's all like clinging to him. Yeah. That's sci-fi, unfortunately.
Well,
I mean, even Star Wars was a subversion of that to a degree.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were talking about Ripley and, the horror thing. I noticed also it's just like a horror movie in terms of you see these characters make bad decisions over and over again that you wouldn't make, or that you say, oh, that's wrong. Don't go down that corridor. Get out of that house. Do that thing. But instead, they're like, you know, they investigate. The guy goes into this alien ship and he falls down into the thing. He's messing with the egg. And then he comes back and then they let him in. You know, all these things. Don't do that. That's like a completely horror movie type. You know,
it is. But in this case, like, Ripley is actually saying, don't bring him in. He's got to be in quarantine until we figure out what's going on. And because there is a nefarious purpose, you know, that the characters don't really know about at the time.
Yeah, it turns out,
like,
that's
why it happens. Like, you know, everything that happens. Yeah, it's deliberate. The corporation's like, wow, a crazy, murderous alien life form. We got to get me one of those.
Also,
and that's actually was another interesting thing to me. I was watching all the way through this for the first time is I had actually forgotten that Ash was an android. And yeah. I didn't actually realize until he had the white sweat, because then I've seen Aliens more recently and I remember Bishop and I'm like, oh, right. Okay. That all makes sense now. Mm-hmm. But it does, you know, like it's nice the way it ties everyone's motivations together by the end. And like the things that happen make more sense than they maybe seem to at the time.
Yeah. That made me think, they don't show, it's not obvious that he's an android at the beginning, but it also made me think like, if they can make an android, why are these computers so clunky?
Because it's the 70s.
They put all their tech into the androids.
Yeah. It's like a biological android.
Well, I think also that, that gets down to the nature of the Nostromo itself. It's not meant to be top of the line. It's a space semi, basically.
Yeah.
So
it's a piece of junk.
Like if you look in a trucker semi, it's probably not going to have top of the line equipment inside. I mean, some of them probably do at this point. You know, there's probably still
those old ones,
trucks that don't have GPS or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
They've still got an AM radio.
But they have an Android co-pilot.
Yes, just absolutely.
Chris?
Probably cheaper to build an Android than to build a whole new ship.
Especially one that can carry 20 million tons of ore.
Yeah, once the technology is there. Yeah.
It carries its own refinery. That's crazy. That's wild.
Yeah, they've been using it for 100 years, probably.
Probably, yeah.
So do we know what year this takes place in?
I never say.
Nope.
And that's fine. You're not meant to know.
They mention Earth, don't they?
They do. Yeah. Earth, like so it's, yeah.
These are humans.
This is the future of humanity. I mean, if the corporate takeover didn't convince you, what will?
Yeah, that's true.
So the last thing I want to talk about in terms of the movie is the chestburster scene, because It's really the most memorable moment of the movie, and for good reason, because one, it's horrifying, and you know, like I said earlier, the actors are having real reactions to that scene, but also because there'd just been nothing like that in movies before. These days, like, it's so visceral, but we just kind of take it for granted because, you know, the stakes have been raised, you know, by things like RoboCop and so forth, and you know, to the point where we are now, where you know, people just, they don't even flinch at that stuff anymore. But in 1979, that was intense, and I was aware of Alien throughout the 80s, but my parents were like, you are not watching that because it is just not appropriate. And like this the chest burster scene took on this sort of mythic air. Like, everyone knew about it, everyone talked about it, like it was known. But you know, even knowing about it, if you haven't actually seen it, like, it's still pretty shocking the first time you see it. Or at least it was back then.
Especially if you don't know what's going to happen, which
is kind of
impossible. If you've seen Spaceballs,
right? Yeah, because it's been so like absorbed into like the public consciousness.
I saw Spaceballs before I saw Aliens, so it spoiled it for me.
Yeah, likewise.
You know, because we were kids and stuff.
You know, it's much less gory in that one because it's just supposed to be silly. But it'd be, yeah,
there's something to be said about the level of gratuity in movies, like gratuitous gore. Viscera violence and stuff, and how that amped up. And yeah, this was definitely like a watermark moment in terms of like showing graphic things in a mainstream film that wasn't a slasher flick or something.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
there's an alien monster that bursts through a man's sternum, mm-hmm. and like he's sitting there twitching
yeah,
and bleeding out as this thing like looks out of his chest and kind of takes stock of the world around it before darting off and disappearing.
Dancing.
Hello, my baby.
Nope.
Just kidding.
I love that Marvel Comics completely ripped off Alien.
Everyone is completely ripped off
Alien. Yeah, but
the Brood is especially...
The Brood is Alien. Like Chris Claremont and Dave Cockrum saw Alien and then were like, we should do that with the X-Men. But you can't have something tear its way out of Wolverine's chest in 1980. So instead it just like slowly turns you into a brood, which is sort of different kind of horror.
Yeah,
but like, I love that that's the one thing they had to change. And also Space Whales and Carol Danvers were there.
As usual.
Yeah.
Space Whales and Carol Danvers make everything better. So
I don't know about the Space Whales.
I love the Space Whales.
That makes Farscape better. I don't know about the other stuff.
Matt Cross 7.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, like, reading X-Men comics as a kid, like I didn't know how much it was just Alien, which is a great thing about comics.
Did the Brood have a queen before the aliens?
No,
they were just the Brood, and then after Aliens came out, then they got a queen.
Then they got the Brood queen.
And come on, Claremont, he was too busy writing about domination and BDSM.
Yeah, which is just an episode of the Avengers,
right?
Like it's. I love going back and looking at the direct connections between like what somebody was watching that week and what made it into comics. Like the entire first 50 issues of the Punisher ongoing series from the 80s, it's literally just the plot of whatever like schlocky action movie Mike Baron had seen that week. Like there's a Class of 1984 story arc. There's a Stone Cold story arc where Frank's a biker who infiltrates a meth dealing gang. Like it's just each of these movies one by one.
Hmm.
Yeah, and before everything was connected on the internet, the media could be their own little islands of media where like, you know, like early video games plagiarized music, like popular music sometimes in their tunes and stuff. I mean, that was a world where the people who would sue you for that music would never encounter that stuff. Whereas today everything's intertwined.
Now they've got ID match.
Yeah.
So as soon as you upload it to YouTube, someone else is getting monetized for your work. It's great. I love it.
I love it. So if we're like segueing into influences, there's also like there's some things in Alien that just seem like gifts to game design, even though they weren't done that way intentionally. But so like the proximity motion detector things that they use, and you know, obviously in the film, it's being used as a way to like ramp up tension, like, you know, something's coming, but you only sort of know where it is, not exactly. And so it's
really, and it's a great diegetic concept, because you know the crew of the Nostromo, because they are space truckers, they don't have access to like high-end scientific equipment. Right. They can't use the tricorder,
cobbling things together. Yeah,
they can't use the Force. They're just, you know, truckers in space, so they cobble together a motion detector. Yeah. That's all they can do.
But this is just like a gift to like game adaptations, both directly of Aliens and other games, because it's just this.
It's
template
tracker.
Yeah, this template for something you can throw up on a HUD and like use as a game mechanic. And then we've also got, you know, great fun things like flamethrowers.
Right. And, you know, crawling through the ducts.
Yeah.
And
ducts.
You know, the self-destruct sequence. I mean,
yeah, that's
Metroid owes a lot to Alien.
Oh, does it?
I was
there's an enemy named Ridley.
Yeah.
And the main character is a lady who fights a parasitic alien. And then at the end, after blowing up the computer, she has to escape before the whole place explodes around her. Yes.
Yeah, like watching Ripley set that self-destruct sequence in motion, I'm like, this is the template for every self-destruct sequence for the next 20 years.
Right.
Like right here. Like,
I know I talked about loving practical effects, but if we could go in and make like a special edition of Alien where Sigourney Weaver is in like Chozo armor and like turns into a morph ball occasionally, that would be great.
I mean, she even strips down to like a bikini and thong at the end, just like Samus if you get a good ending.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I noticed this. When watching the movie, watching Sigourney Weaver move around, it looks like Samus. Like the way she carries herself. I'm not joking. Like there's
how she's
a couple
got her
poses.
Arm stuck out and she has the other arm resting on top of it.
Yeah, there's just a couple poses where like I'm just like, you know, she's just standing there and it looks like they looked at it. Well, it looks like some artist in Super Metroid or Metroid looked at it and just,
I mean, that's entirely possible.
You know, but that ruined my best joke. I was gonna say the best Alien game is Metroid, but there's the Chozo too. That fossilized dude, the elephant guy.
Yeah. Like
the space jockey.
Statues of the old civilization, and yeah.
I got it.
Now, did Ripley ever get the Varia in those movies?
Only in Alien Resurrection.
Okay. Doesn't count.
Well, in Alien 3, she kind of goes for a lava bath, but it doesn't work out so well.
Yeah, she forgot the gravity suit.
Yeah,
that's
the
problem.
She needed the gravity suit first.
Oh. Anyway, yes, Metroid owes a lot to Alien, but a lot of games, you know, like there's Alien Crush by Naxat, which is a pinball game that is basically just like, here's, you know, everything that H.R. Giger has ever drawn. There's Darkseed. I don't know if you guys ever played that, but that's a graphical adventure game from the early 90s from the CD-ROM era. And it's very, very Alien kind of meets Lovecraft, where you're a guy who discovers that he has this like bizarre alien god thing implanted in him, and it's going to grow and you know, evacuate his body and kill him in the process if he doesn't get rid of it within like 24 hours or something. And all the artwork is done by H.R. Giger. So they basically were just like, hey, Giger, we're basically going to rip off Alien and put it in, you know, like a Lovecraft setting, like a modern day sort of mansion with a parallel universe. Could you do that? And he was like, yeah, sure, whatever.
I would call that biological horror.
Yeah.
Like a mixture of just terrifying parasitic organisms and stuff and biologically themed ribby like structures and stuff.
Like Giger's style is so distinctive. It's just kind of a whole subgenre to itself that people draw from.
There's a film there's a recent film is like Corridor Set. What was that? Some kind of like, there's like an alien refugee encampment and a guy's arm is like a cannon and stuff.
You're thinking of,
it's a last 10
Sector
years.
Seven. It's,
District 13.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah. That was terrifying, crazy, kind of weird kind of mixtures of mixing biological with technological and, alien and stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, at the furthest extent, you know, the alien concept has been sort of adapted into just like standard zombie panic. So you have something like, Halo's Flood, which is very similar to Brood.
And Doom.
Doom, yeah.
Doom is like Space Marines and stuff, and that's
I guess there are like the Revenant type. Yeah.
Bungie got into some of that style even way back in like Pathways into Darkness.
I mean, that's more Cthulhu.
That's more Lovecraftian, yeah.
And Doom is also a corporation screwing things up. Story.
That's true. Well, yeah. That's what corporations do. You ever been on social media? Anyway, yeah. So lots of games have borrowed heavily, liberally from Alien. We can't even begin to list all the games, the influences. But I mean, Contra, geez, like the whole Red Falcon thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and R-Types. Bosses,
the Dobekaros or whatever it's called, Dobokaritas. It's something.
Super Mario Brothers.
Yoshi.
Only the movie. Only the movie.
Yeah, you're right.
That's true.
Bowser jumps. Yoshi was like, yeah. Let's actually talk about the games that were based on Alien. Not all Aliens games, just the games, because there, I would say, are four games based on Alien. Would you guys agree? Do you think there's more? I think
those were the ones that seem to be, you know, just drawn from Alien as opposed to the sequels.
Once Aliens came out in 1986, everyone was like, that's it. That's our video game. That's every video game forever from now on. And so that was all she wrote.
So, you know, it's a squad shooter.
Yeah, I mean, when
the
Alien
whole movie is a squad
when
shooter.
When Alien Isolation came out, oh my God, 4 years ago, I guess, that was a revelation because it was about Alien. It was about evoking the horror and creeping suspense, terror and suspense of the original Alien, not about the like, go Marines, go! Yeah,
destroy everything.
We are leaving. Yeah, not the Aliens style. It was just like the you're trapped with aliens and you have to survive. That was great. I would say that video games did not start out quite that way. The the very first adaptation of Alien was created by Fox for Atari 2600. And it is not, I would say, it does not successfully evoke the spirit of the movie.
Now, on the bright side, it may be a better Pac-Man than Pac-Man on the Atari 2600.
Yes, it is a Pac-Man clone, unabashedly.
It is straight up Pac-Man.
And it is better than you know,
Atari 2600s.
It's a good
Howard
Pac-Man.
Scott Warshaw or Todd Fry? It's Todd Fry, right?
Todd Fry, dude. Okay. Yeah. Well, I was just gonna say it's a pretty good Pac-Man clone. It's got some
with a little bit of Frogger clone bolted on.
Yeah, although I played it for a while and I couldn't figure out whether you could actually do anything with your flamethrower.
I couldn't figure that either. I tried to.
You can't kill the monsters.
Theoretically, you're supposed to be able to.
But you do get power pellets that you can eat the aliens, basically destroy them.
Yes, remember when Ripley eats power pellets and the aliens turn blue and she eats them?
Yeah,
and
they go blue.
I think the pellet is an antacid that neutralizes their blood
that
long enough for her to devour them.
Must be.
This is the other thing that I want in our special edition of Alien is like one of the, like we get a pastel pink alien, a pastel yellow alien, Ripley eats one.
I think there's a toy line like that actually.
Well, and the dots that you're going over are supposed to be alien eggs. That you're neutralizing.
Oh, really?
That's what it said in the manual.
Antacid.
So we need the scene in the new movie where you're just going down the corridor like stomping on every egg on the way down.
by the way, this is the origin of this game. I do not know the actual origin, but these types of games came about very frequently because there was a developer who made a Pac-Man clone and it just had it sitting around and they're like, oh, we need a alien game. And so they merged like the two
swap
together.
The sprites in.
And then there you go. Now it's an alien game.
I do actually quite like the sprites in this game. I think
they're kind of cute.
for the 2600, I think they look pretty good. Kind of scary aliens.
They're better than a lot of the other like maze game sprites from that era, which were really clunky.
It's still just not convincing. I don't know. If I were a kid, I'd be like, well, for one thing, if I were a kid at that point, I would not have watched Alien yet because I had not watched Alien yet.
Yep.
But if I were a grown man who was at least 18 and old enough to see an R-rated movie like that, I would have said, this is not my Alien experience. Where is the creeping terror? I would have been very disappointed in 1980. Yeah.
So decent Pac-Man clone, not that exciting as compared to the movie.
Just wait for Weird Science.
I think it's a neat game, though.
Yeah,
in retrospect,
it's not bad. It's a nice game for that era.
Yeah,
right.
But yeah, much more interesting is the C64 version of Alien, which came along a few years later. it's really complicated. It's and impressive. I did not have time to really dig into this game. So just watching some videos and reading, you know, like an overview of the game, I'm kind of at a loss. It's almost like FTL or something.
Yeah, it's like an adventure simulation. There was actually a recent indie game that came out, which is about directing all your crew on a small ship and trying not to die.
FTL?
Yeah, that's
the one you're talking about?
Was it FTL? Yeah. Okay.
Maybe like that. There's another one. There's probably another one.
So you have these like multiple floor views of the Nostromo in very simplified graphics, and you're like seven crew members, and you're basically kind of doing this turn-based thing, telling them what to do. But it's this very complex simulation. You can like pick up tools and use them and tell people to go in and out of the vents. And like your crew members have actual like emotional states, so they can be like calm or they can be freaked out. Like it starts to feel almost like a Dwarf Fortress kind of simulation, although it's not that complicated.
I mean, I think that is really important because, you know, the compromised emotional state of the crew was a huge part of how Alien happened. You know, like I was talking about the actors responding to things, but like for a lot of that movie, a lot of the scenes that involved Veronica Cartwright, she was actually like freaked out of her mind, just because it was so intense and, you know, it was such a harrowing experience that hadn't really been produced in Hollywood before. So people weren't really prepared for that. They didn't know how to cope. And so, you know, capturing that in a video game, that's remarkable.
Yeah. And so this is like it's a, you know, very simple graphics and turn-based gameplay, but it draws a whole lot directly from the scenario of the movie. But then evidently kind of remixes it. Cause if you're playing the long game version of this, basically it just like picks a random crew member to be the one who dies first and picks another crew member to be the one who's the traitorous android. So you don't necessarily know how it's going to play out.
So it's kind of like Clue?
Kind of like that. And there's also, and evidently there's like multiple win conditions. So you can end up doing it like the movie where, you know, most of the people die and then you blow up the ship and escape. But apparently you actually get more points if you manage to kill the alien without blowing up. So you can actually succeed at like drawing the alien over to an airlock and blowing it out without scuttling the whole ship.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
The thing that came to mind for me when I was watching this was Five Nights at Freddy's.
I can see that.
Yeah. Like you're kind of like looking at the floor plan and sort of managing everything. And then occasionally the alien shows up.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's actually like a little bit scary because that's
well, there's this big cool graphic of the alien. It's the only only interesting graphic in the whole game because everything else is this low resolution
stick figures and then the alien.
Yeah, and then there's this huge like half screen detail.
So this is a prequel for Five Nights at Freddy's.
It's a prequel to Night Trap, which was the prequel to Five Nights at Freddy's.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say the board game analogy is pretty good in terms of. This is something like it could be a board game, but you want the computer to facilitate all this, some of the grunt work of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. I've never actually played this. I tried to find the ROM disk image this morning to play it, but I didn't get a chance. But I looked at it, and it looks awesome.
Yeah, it looks really interesting.
I'm glad that you were prevented from doing crimes.
Yeah, I almost went to jail this morning.
Next to the Alien games based on Alien, I guess, is Alien Trilogy for PlayStation 1 and Saturn by Probe and published by Acclaim.
It's pronounced Probe.
Is it? Okay.
Are they French? Yeah. I think they are French.
Are they?
No, they are not. I think they're British.
I could look at this game for like 2 minutes, so I'll let you guys handle this one.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't really have that much to do with the original Alien. Supposedly, it's based on all three of the movies, but... Mm-hmm. It
draws from them all, and like the environments are, you know, it draws in these visual elements, but other than that, it's a mid-90s first person shooter, and that's what
it's not. It's not an attempt to capitalize on the unique strengths of the film. It's just an attempt to take, you know, the current hotness and shoehorn some alien elements into it, and with less success, I would say, than Alien versus Predator for Jaguar a few years before.
Yeah,
when a Jaguar game outdoes your PS1 game, you got problems.
You're in trouble.
Yeah. Well, yeah, apparently they actually mo-capped the enemy aliens for this, and that was like a selling point for them. They actually put people in a sense of mo-cap, but
they're just like wandering around aimlessly.
Yeah, it's a mid-90s PS1 shooter, and so, you know, it's low frame rate, kind of pixelated enemies, and you can't really tell that they were mocap.
So. So what I know is I've never played this either, but it looks like from watching a YouTube video that it's a shoot everything that moves kind of FPS instead of like the suspense and things. And then
it is.
The comments are instructional because a lot of people were talking about how it completely terrified them as kids or something. Because I guess I don't know if the aliens are jumping out at you or something.
I think they do. Like they fall out of the ceiling and that kind of thing. Okay. And it's also like, you know, it's trying to recreate sort of the hopelessness of the movies. And so evidently your weapons are not really very good. Yeah. And so you just, I was watching someone playing this as a review, and it's just like, you're just going to die a lot.
Speaking of weapons, this is a slightly tangential thing. Is there's no proof in the movie that the fire flamethrower actually does any damage to this alien, right? Mm, I mean, it just maybe scares it off, but we don't know, you know? So like nothing damaged it except the airlock maneuver. Something.
Pretty much. Anyway. And that one, there was that one gas it didn't like. I was always wondering why there was this control panel to flood the escape pod with like various kinds of toxic gas. But
are they toxic or was it like liquid oxygen? It might have just been
cold.
Yeah, I feel like my thought was that it was
she
just
tried like three different gases until she hit one that it actually didn't like.
I thought it was just like a loose tube that connected the cryo chamber, so it would have been some sort of cold.
I don't know. She has a control panel that literally has different like gas names on it.
Does
but,
it?
Like if you pause
like
it,
Yanni
on the
frame, and.
Yeah, but no, these are actually like chemical compounds like on this one. And she hits like three of them, and it's like the fourth one that finally makes it scream and move.
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyways.
Yeah, all right. I want to play this Alien trilogy, though. Mm. Too bad I didn't get to do it in time.
Mm.
It looks neat.
It's a 90s FPS.
I mean, I like, as far as the 90s FPS aesthetic, it's nostalgic.
If I'm going to have that, like mindless first person shooter style, I don't want anything more than a 2.5D engine. I want like Build Engine or the Doom Engine or the Marathon Engine or something.
Build
like,
is the best.
Yeah, just, well, one of those, any of those, just like give me those. Like I don't want polygons, damn it. Just keep those out. Like if you're gonna be dumb and fast paced, just give me like dumb fast paced graphics.
No. Are there polygons in this?
Yeah,
I don't remember seeing any.
It's all 3D models.
Okay.
Well, the enemies were sprites, but
okay, there
but
you
the
go.
Environments were modeled.
Yeah.
Okay.
And finally, we come to the best and last of the Alien games, which is not technically retro, but it had such an old school mindset to it that I'm willing to allow it. And that is Alien Isolation, developed by Creative Assembly and published by Sega 2014. And this was a labor of love by people who really got the first movie and said, we don't want to make an Aliens game. We want to make an Alien game. And so it is a first-person survival horror game. It does turn into a shooter, like more straightforward at the end. But most of the game is a direct sequel to Alien, starring, I just blanked out her name, Amanda Ripley, Ellen's daughter, who is actually, you know, canonical. She's mentioned in the intro to Aliens as having become an old woman in the time that Ripley was floating aimlessly out in space. But you are trying to survive your way through Sebastopol, a space station that, of course, has been taken over by some aliens. There's not a lot of them, at least at first, but they are omnipresent and extremely scary, and you have to creep around silently and avoid them, and you really cannot defeat them. So it's just a game about avoidance and stealth and creeping and... also, there's robots because androids are evil and they hate you and they'll try to kill you and give your position away and so forth. So it's an interesting game.
Apparently, they got like a lot of the, like several of the people who worked on the original Alien to come in and consult. And so they really went all out on recreating the aesthetic and the ambiences to the point where they like created computer screens and then ran them through VHS cassettes to give them these like old video effects because that's what it had in the 70s version.
Yeah, I mean, the aesthetics of this game, the Sebastopol station really feels like it's cut from the same industrial molds as the Nostromo. And you get, you know, those different areas. There's like a medical area and a science area and so forth. And each of those has a different feel, but it feels very authentic with, you know, the shape of the architecture and the signage and labels and everything, the computer screens. It's all just very, very true to the original Alien. But it plays really well. Like, it is one of the most intense and, I guess, tense, really, games that I've played. Because, you know, there is constantly this alien around. And it's possible to outsmart it, and there are a few scripted sequences, but a lot of it, it's just kind of moving randomly through the station, and if you make noise, it will start, you know, it'll realize you're out there, and it'll hunt for you, and you'll have to, like, hide in a locker for 5 minutes and wait for it to creep past, and it'll eventually go away. And one of the really cool things about the game is that the save stations, it doesn't have save anywhere mechanics. It's very much about a save station, like, find a point where you can save your progress, which is a very sort of old school approach, but it works here because a lot of the save stations are exposed. And so there is this risk. You're like, well, I need to save my game because it's been 25 minutes since I last saved and I've made some progress. And, you know, I've opened up some of the map and I've collected things and so on and so forth. But there's an alien roaming around. And if I just make a break for the save station, it's going to see me and it's going to come over and kill me as soon as I save or before I even save. So it just really ratchets up the tension. I don't know. Have you guys played Isolation?
I haven't actually played it, but I watched some of it. I think a really interesting thing about it is another thing they did to increase this tension is that so much of the time the alien behavior, like, isn't scripted. It's just, it's running its own little AI routine. So it's going to do different things, different times. And apparently one of the things they did, to make it seem like it's learning, because there's not actually a machine learning algorithm in here, but they had different levels of AI behaviors that it sort of unlocks over the course of the game. So it's like its behaviors get more complex as you go on. But again, there's this sense that you can never quite predict where it's going to be or what it's going to be doing. And, you know, maybe even sometimes it'll do something that'll luckily help you, but you don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely marauders on the space station and, you know, the robots and stuff, the aliens will ignore the robots. But if there are other humans who are, you know, trying to fight you, if they make noise, the alien will come after them and that can, you know, expose you. But if if enemies are coming after you and shooting at you and you manage to hide, the alien will just come and clear out the room and you're like, well, okay, thanks. So yeah, it's interesting. It's very dynamic. It's a really, really cool game. And I went to see this in the UK before it was announced, or when it was very first announced. And, you know, Sega was like, hey, we're going to show off a game about Alien. I was like, okay, sure, I'll go on this trip. Not expecting anything of it. But then they took us to Creative Assembly's offices and let us demo the game. And I was just like, I can't believe someone actually adapted the spirit and essence of Alien into a video game. It really was like, it went from zero expectations to being, you know, mind blowing. And I really love this game. I think it's fantastic.
I remember the critical hype about this game. It's probably Jeremy's fault, but
it was me.
A lot of people thought it was very scary and suspenseful and stuff. But, you know, I haven't played it because I don't play games that are any younger than 20 years. So I'm hardcore. It looks cool. I want to play it.
It's really good. And you can buy it for like $3 now, you know, on Steam or, you know, PS4 or whatever. It's a modern gen game and is easily available. It hasn't gone out of print and sold pretty well, I think. So it's readily available.
You have to buy it, though, man.
That's OK. It's seriously like $5.
OK, worst. Good.
Like, okay. It's worth it for sure.
Go check. And
I think there was an expansion that I never had a chance to play that... I can't remember if it like gave you scenarios from the original Alien.
I think,
Alien.
Yeah, they did actually recreate some of the like self-contained scenes from the original movie. Yeah. And they actually got some of the original actors back to do voice.
That's right. I need to play those.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Yep. Yeah. It, like I said, it's a labor of love by people who really appreciated the first Alien for its uniqueness and tried to turn that into a video game. And I wish, you know, I wish more great movies had that. I wish, you know, more developers were like, let's really translate what makes this film unique into a video game experience. It can be done. Alien Isolation is proof, but it's pretty rare.
Especially with the technology we have these days. Like, to go back to a 79 movie and do that with our, you know, we can really do it now with the tech we have now, graphics-wise and everything. It'd be cool to look back at some of those older, you know, films and recreate them in video game form.
Yeah, I mean, just think how many mediocre Star Wars and Star Trek video games there are that just don't quite catch the spirit.
What else could we recreate? Maybe the black hole.
I would love that. That would be, especially if the ending, you actually end up in hell, trapped inside Maximilian. I'd be into that. When are we doing a black hole podcast, guys?
My dad used to love that movie.
It's not a good movie, but I love it. It's so weird.
I haven't seen it in ages.
So Star Trek The Next Generation, or Star Trek The Motion Picture, Alien and the Black Hole. where three different studios attempts to do the Star Wars thing. And they're all very different and all very hit very distinct degrees of success. But I love all of them for different reasons. Anyway, I think that's it for Alien. We don't need to belabor the point. It really is like a super influential movie. And, you know, we've pretty much spoiled the whole thing, but it's a movie that I can go back to and watch over and over again. And I'm not someone who enjoys horror, but this is just such a well-constructed film. And it's such a foundational pillar of so much sci-fi that, it's just... It's right up there with you know, Blade Runner for me. Like, Ridley Scott used to be so good. What happened, man? What'd you do? It's like James Cameron. All these guys who made great stuff in the early 80s.
But Battle Angel was good.
My last thought is that Alien is like a comfortable place to go because it reminds me of Metroid.
Okay, yes. The
might be the only person for whom Alien is comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a nice place to go.
I'm sure it's nice and cozy inside of inside of someone's chest.
Yeah, glad you didn't.
To burst out.
Okay.
All right. Any final thoughts on Alien?
I mean, I think I'm in the same place as you. I'm not a horror guy, but I definitely enjoyed like going back and watching this all the way for the first time. It was a great experience.
All right. Well, at some point we will tackle Aliens because that's an even more influential movie. And wow, its impact on video games and the number of video games based directly on it are innumerable, like the sands on the beach, the stars in the sky.
It's going to be a 3-hour podcast.
Probably. Yeah. But that's not happening today because we didn't prep for it.
We need extra boost for that one.
Yeah. So everyone, tell us about yourselves and where we can find you. I guess I'll start. Hi, I'm Jerry Parrish. You've been listening to Retronauts. Retronauts.com is where you'll find this podcast. Also iTunes, Libsyn. That's where we're hosted these days. You can support us on Patreon if you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more like it or more not like it. We do a variety of things. You can go to patreon.com/retronauts. And for $3 a month, you can subscribe and listen to each episode a week early with higher bitrate quality and no advertisements. So it's a dangling enticement that we are holding there in front of you. And I think it's a good one. So check us out. Anyway, Ben.
I'm Ben Elgin. Most of my other like retro focused endeavors are on hiatus right now, but you can always keep up with me on Twitter where I am Kirin, K-I-R-I-N-N. And that's about all that's updated right now.
I'm Chris Sims, and if you don't mind me missing what are, in retrospect, some extremely obvious pieces of imagery, then you can find all of my stuff by going to the-isb.com. That's the ISB, my website, where you'll find links to comic books that I write and columns that I write around the web and other podcasts that I do, including Apocrypals, which is the podcast where two non-believers read through the Bible and its assorted, associated, extremely weird non-canonical texts, but we try not to be jerks about it.
And I'm Ben Jedwards. You can find me on Twitter at Ben Jedwards, and I'm still kind of building joysticks at bxfoundry.com. Temporarily stopped taking orders because I got too many, but I have a feeling I will do it again later.
And we'll look forward to it. In the meantime, Retronauts will be back in probably like a week with another episode. We might have one this Friday. I don't know. We do bonus episodes every other Friday. So just keep your eyes on the Retronauts feed. And we promised not to explode out of your chest when you're least expecting it.